Okay, I thought I'd take this opportunity to add a little more to what we said last week. We were speaking about the that the Torah recognizes that its greatest enemy is the religious instinct, the unbridled religious instinct of man, as it's expressed in his desire for an exclusive relationship with God of his own imagining, which is why the Torah places such a serious penalty on those who sacrifice outside of the prescribed area of the temple. I'd like to just show you, when you find a theme in the Torah, it's if it's a basic theme, it appears in many places. And in last week's reading, the reading on the Sabbath last week, the reading contains a very interesting area. And that's the area of the bringing of the first fruits, that in Deuteronomy 26, so the Torah describes very clearly when you come to the land, 26:1, that God, your God, gives you, and you inherit it, and you dwell in it, then you must take from the first fruits of the land that God has given you, and you put it in the, put these fruits in the basket, and you should go to the place that God will choose. The Torah doesn't say where it is at that time, but he will choose a place that his name resides there, and that place, of course, is the temple in Jerusalem. Now, the interesting thing about this is the that the first fruit, the details of the first fruits, how much you have to bring, and it's a small amount. There's no amount from the Torah, even the smallest amount. But you must take this fruit, and you must bring it, put it in a basket, and you must bring it to Jerusalem. And then it says in verse 3, and this is the verse I want you to concentrate on, because there is something strange, very strange in this verse. And I want you to to be able to select it, to tell me exactly what is strange in the verse. Okay, that's Deuteronomy 26:3. It says, "And you shall come to the priest that will be in those days," meaning in your days, the days that, whatever days they may be, "and you should say to him," and what should you say to him? This is what you should say to the priest. You should say, "I have spoken this day to God your God, because I came to the land which God has sworn to our fathers to give to us." Okay? That verse. Now, before we analyze what's strange in that verse, something very strange, just to, in case you're not familiar with these biblical verses, if you take a look at the next verse, it says the priest takes should take the basket from your hand, and he places it before the altar of God. Okay, fine. Then it goes back and it says, "And you shall answer and you shall say before God your God." And what shall you say? And it tells you what to say. That Arami tried to destroy Laban the Aramite, tried to destroy my father, went down to Egypt, etc., etc., the whole story. Then you keep going, it tells you the story of the fact that the Jews were in Egypt, that they cried to God, that God saw their pain, and God took us out of Egypt with an outstretched arm, okay, with a strong hand and outstretched arm, and with great miracles, etc. And he brought us, in verse 9, he brought us to this place, and he gave us this land, the land that flows with milk and honey, and now, behold, I bring the fruits of the land which you, God, have given me, and I place it before God, and you should place it before God, and then you shall bow down before God your God, and you should be very happy with the good that God has given you and your house, you and the Levite and the stranger which is in your midst. Okay. Now, so we see there's a whole system going on here. The fruits must be brought to the priest in the temple. And then there is this verbiage, these statements that must be made by the pilgrim who comes with his first fruits to this one. Okay. Now let's go back to this verse over here. Verse 26, verse 3. Now, there's something that stands out. Actually, there's two things that stand out in that verse, but there's one that I'm thinking of especially. And that verse is something very strange. Okay. Does anybody want to volunteer what that is? What exactly it is? Anybody? I'd rather give you the opportunity before I point it out.
Okay. We're waiting to see if anybody wants to take a stab.
Okay.
Does anybody want to take a stab? What about that the person spoke to the Lord, his God?
Okay. Okay. Good. Yeah. In other words, he's correct. Exactly. You see, what is strange over here is like this, that what is he supposed to say? And by the way, this is all, you know, I mean, as you know, this is all formulated in halacha, precisely. In other words, when the pilgrim comes, he must say this. This is what the verse says. Verse 3 says, you shall come to the Kohen that will be in that generation, and you shall say to him, and this is what he must say. He says, he must say, I have spoken this day to God your God. Now, this is strange. Why is it strange? He's saying, God your God? If you notice, that's why I went through with you the entire story that he tells. Actually, the word higadati, which means I have spoken today to God, your God, is the word haggadah. You recognize that. Haggadah means more than just saying. The word to say in Hebrew is amar. Haggid means to tell a story. And, of course, he has to go through the whole story over here. It's a long story. And he has to say precise. He can't omit a word. He must say every single word. So he goes through the whole story, and what does he say? And he says, take a look at verse 10. In conclusion, and now I brought the fruits of the land which you, God, have given me. Okay? And you should place it before God, your God. All right? Now, and you should bow down before God, your God. What is the purpose of this is to show that God is to praise God for all the good that he has done for the pilgrim. The pilgrim must be aware of the good, the bounty that God has given him. If that is the case, so how could his very first statement, that opening statement, is almost a denial of that? He says, I have spoken today to God, your God. It should have been to God, my God, our God. Oh, what is it, your God? That's exactly the opposite, it would seem, of what the Torah is trying to accomplish. The Torah is trying to bring the pilgrim closer to God, to make him appreciate what God has done for him. And here in his very opening statement, he says to the priest, I have a story to tell. I'm going to tell a story before God, your God. Excluding, it would sound like he's excluding himself. What does this mean? What kind of meaning is this? I mean, we know, as I said last week, we don't read the Bible. We study the Bible, because every word in the Bible contains numerous concepts and ideas, and every word has to be precise. We can't just gloss over. It's not something that's like a human, something that's written by man that's subject to error. This is perfection itself. So how could it be that the Torah says that the pilgrim must say, and this is what Allah is, he must say to God, your God. If he says to God, our God, he didn't fulfill the commandment. Okay, there is something else that stands out in that same verse. You see, sometimes what we do when we analyze Torah in the Talmudic method, we look for more questions. Because when we find another question, every question opens up a new avenue. A question isn't just a difficulty. A question is not something that we dislike. A question is something which opens up channels.
Rabbi?
Yes.
All right.
There's one more thing that's strange in that verse.
Okay. All right. They want you to reread the verse in your translation because yours is different than ours.
Oh, okay.
So
I'm just making up my own translation. I don't have a real translation.
Okay. Well, now, you're not making up an interpretation to go with it, are you?
No. Well, the interpretation...
Okay.
I'm going to bring you the source for, but the translation is
right.
My own. I'll tell you what, you read me your translation.
Okay, it says, and thou shalt go unto the priest,
right,
who shall be in those days,
right.
And say unto him,
right.
I profess this day, that's literally confess this day unto the Lord thy God.
Now, confess that. Now, the word is, it comes from Haggadah. Haggadah day. Haggadah means to tell a story.
Tell a story. Haggadah, yeah, okay.
That's just like the Haggadah on Passover.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, this very chapter, by the way, is used in the Haggadah on Passover.
Right.
Okay, good.
All right. That is, I am come
right.
unto the country which the Lord, that's the Tetragrammaton,
right.
Right. swore unto our fathers to give us.
Exactly.
All right.
Did I say it differently?
You changed it a little bit. All right.
I confess. Say again. I confess this day. What did it say after that?
Yeah, he said, "The God, your God, is the
exactly. Okay.
The Lord thy God.
It's the Lord your God.
It's the same meaning.
Same meaning.
All right. Then Jim Long had a statement. What was yours? All right. He said that you're using this as a pilgrim in the land.
Oh, the pilgrim. Yeah, I mean to say the man is a pilgrimage, because wherever he is...
It's a pilgrimage. He's not a pilgrim. He can be in the land, but he's making a pilgrimage from
right.
Nazareth or
exactly.
Tiberias
exactly.
Or Beersheba.
Right.
Okay. All right. So, okay. Well, all right. We got that cleared. Thank you.
Okay. Sure.
Wait a minute. Hold on. We got one more. All right. Gary Buchanan, and he's going to come around to the... and ask the question also. Okay. Here's Gary.
Rabbi,
yes, sir.
You mentioned that he's changing around here. You mentioned that the person speaking didn't identify as God being his God,
right.
But yet it appears that he does identify with him when he uses the word "us" there
yes,
at the end of
correct.
That verse.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay.
That is true. But we still have to understand why he didn't say in the first place, "God, our God."
Mm-hmm.
Why does he say, "God, your God"? So that remains, that still remains a question. You are right. There's no question about it. When you read the verses that follow again, all the verses, it's clear that he is saying God is his God. He's trying to express his thanks to God, his God. But yet you still have that discrepancy over here where he says to the priest, "God, your God."
Okay.
Okay.
Now you were looking for a second thing in the text.
Yeah. Now I said that the way we... And when we analyze the Talmudic method, we look for other questions.
Mm-hmm.
There is another problem in this text, okay? Not as blatant as the first one. The first one, it's a little more difficult to catch this one. It's based upon a principle, and the principle is that there are no extra words or expressions in the Bible. That God is very economical. He doesn't waste words. So in the Bible, as a matter of fact, in the Bible we say that one verse can contain many concepts, but the opposite is impossible. To say that two verses contain one concept is an impossibility. So God is very economical in his wording in the Bible, and every word counts. There's nothing extra. Now there is something extra in this verse. What can anyone pick it out? There's something extra there that is not necessary. Not necessary. Which, as a matter of fact, is a little absurd. Okay? Hello? Are we on?
Okay, we're on.
Okay.
All right,
if you,
Jim
if
Long.
If anybody wants to take a stab at it, okay? If not, I'll...
All right, Jim Long.
Go ahead.
It's where it says that he's entered the land that the Lord gave to their fathers.
All right. Jim said that... that I am come unto the land which the Lord swore unto our fathers to give us.
No, that really is necessary because.
Okay.
Well, ask him why.
The reason why he's saying that is, because what he's trying to say is he's trying to express humility, that the land is not mine because I deserve it. The land is mine because God swore to my forefathers that they will, that their seed will inherit. It was because of them, not because of me. Not because of my virtue, it's their virtue that gave me this land. If it weren't for them, I wouldn't have anything. So he's being humble in his expression over here. He's not saying that he's special because he has the land. He deserves the land. He doesn't deserve anything. It happens to be that Abraham was a very righteous man, and God swore to Abraham that his seed will inherit the land. So it's because of his father Abraham, not because of him.
He was born.
That's why he says it. But it's a good observation. I mean, why it was necessary to say that was a good point. But there's something else in this verse which is really a little bit absurd, actually.
I would say that it's to say unto him, and I say this day. You got a repetitive phrase.
Well, see, there are two things. One is instruction. This is telling you what to do. It's telling him what to do. You should say to him, say what? Okay? Quote. And this is the quote that he has.
And I said, okay, all right.
Okay. What's strange is the very beginning of the passage, of the verse, because the verse says you should come to the priest that will be in those days. Well, of course. I mean, how is it possible to come to a priest that exists in other days? Anytime you go to to someone, he has to exist in your days. If he doesn't exist in your generation, then obviously you can't see him. You can't go to the Aaron the priest. Aaron the priest passed away. You can't go to any other priest of past generations. You must go to the priest that's in your generation, in those days. So this is simply extra. All it had to say was, and you should go to the priest, and you should say to him. We have many times in Leviticus, for instance, where it says that you should go to the priest. When to the Kohen, you have to go to, I just like to use the word priest, so if it's possible, I'll use the word Kohen instead, okay? Because the word priest always has a connotation of religious practices and rites and rituals, which Torah doesn't have, because we only have halacha. So if it's okay with everyone, I'll use the word Kohen from now on. So it says in Leviticus many times that you should come to the Kohen to show him the leprosy. He has to pronounce it. It doesn't say over there you should go to the Kohen that's in your generation. Obviously, if you're going to the Kohen, he must exist in your generation. So this is a complete redundancy, okay? And there is no redundancy. That's one of the principles of Torah. There's no redundancy in Torah. So Rashi, of course, the great commentary, immediately explains this. He says like this. He says that you must respect the Kohen. You must have respect for the Kohen in your generation, just like any Kohen in any other generation. Okay? Which means to say that, the Kohen that is in your generation is not inferior to the Kohen in any other generation. Now, you have the same problem, all right? You have the same problem before in, just give me a moment, it's in Deuteronomy. We don't have to take out another book. It's Deuteronomy 17:9. Am I right? 17:9? And it says, you should come to the priests and the Levites and to the judge that will be in those days. Okay? Am I right? Deuteronomy 17:9, right? Okay? So over here, the rabbis ask the same question. They say, well, what does it mean? You should come to the judge that's in your generation, in those days. Of course, you can't come to the judge from previous generations. So the rabbis say, the Talmudic scholars say, that this means to tell you something, to teach you something. It means to say you must respect the scholars in your generation, even if they are not as great as the scholars in the previous generation. You must have the same veneration for them that you would have for a Samuel, all right? For the greatest teacher, for a Moses. You must have the same. In other words, the rabbis say Jephthah. In his generation is as great as Samuel, which means to say that in his generation you must, even though Yiftach was not as great as Samuel, but you must respect him as much as you would respect a Samuel. Why? Which means to say like this, that you must subordinate yourself to the authority of the generation, to the man who has the knowledge in your generation. And you can't say, well, he doesn't have as much knowledge as previous generations. Could be he doesn't. You may be right. But the fact is, you must follow the greatest knowledge that's available to you. And you must treat that knowledge as if it's absolute, because that's the best you have. And you cannot be derogatory towards a teacher, a scholar, a judge, a member of the Sanhedrin, if he isn't as great a scholar as the scholars of previous generations. Because he is in charge, he is the authority, God entrusts the Torah to him because of his knowledge, and you must respect that man as if he were the greatest scholar. Okay? So there we have the same problem, and the answer of the rabbis. Now Rashi says the same thing over here. He says, over here it's trying to teach you that the idea is that the Kohen, the priest, or you must also treat him, no matter, even if he isn't as great as the previous ones, you must treat him as if he were just as great. Now Nachmanides raises a question. He says, I don't understand, he says. He says, a judge, I could say, you know, there were superior judges, greater people than I have today, so I have the problem. But a Kohen is the same, he is the same Kohen. I mean, you can't be a superior Kohen. All you have to do to be born, to be a Kohen is to be born from a family whose father is a Kohen. Okay, so there's not much to do. I mean, you are born a Kohen. A Kohen, you cannot become a Kohen. A scholar, the institution of scholarship is totally dependent on the individual. It doesn't matter where he is, what he is. He could even be a person who's not permitted to, he could be a bastard, he could be a person, a mamzer, a person that's not permitted to come intermarry into the congregation of Israel. But he could still be the greatest scholar in his generation. There it's totally democratic. Okay? So, and scholarship is democratic. Alright? But I could say a greatest scholar, a worst scholar, but you cannot say, a better Kohen. How could you say a better Kohen, a better priest, or an inferior priest? This is just a matter of birthright. Is he born a Kohen? Nachmanides raised this question on Rashi. I believe the answer is, what Rashi means is as follows. There is another verse in the Torah where it speaks about the tribe of Levi. All right? The tribe of Levi, when Moses blesses the tribes at the end of his life, okay, before he died, so it says, this is Deuteronomy 33:10, and here it's speaking about the 33:8 tells you, and he spoke to Levi, and then 33:10 it says, they teach your laws to Jacob and your Torah to Israel. Okay, and they place the incense in your nostrils and the sacrifices on your altars. Okay, it means that they're the ones that do they do both. You see, they teach the Torah and they also are the ones that bring the offerings in the temple. Okay, now. Now it's an interesting thing, but what does this mean? We said that knowledge is really democratic. You don't have to have any specific birthright. Even if a person is a no matter what his birthright is, he can still be the greatest scholar, and people will respect him for it and come to him for knowledge. But what it means is like this. That actually the tribe of Levi was designated to be free in order to study Torah. In a society, you cannot have everybody free. People have to work. There are economic responsibilities. But it is possible to free a segment of the population so that that segment of the population can devote their time, have the ability to devote their time to knowledge. You can't force them to do it. Okay, nobody ever forced the Kohen to sit and study. But the Torah, what the Torah did was it gave one segment of the population, it gave them the obligation to work in the temple, which really wasn't much, actually. It came out about 2 weeks out of the year, maybe a little more, but Not much more than that. So the Kohen was a pretty free man. So the Kohen was really the one that had the opportunity to study Torah. And on the whole, they did. And they were really designated. That was their purpose. Their designation was to be teachers and scholars as well as serving in the temple. And this combination, you see, is important because if you notice in Deuteronomy 33:10, it's placed in the same verse. The fact that they teach and the fact that they're the ones that are in charge of bringing the sacrifices. No one else is permitted to do so. You remember that was the story with the rebellion of Korach, where he decided that it should be democratic who brings the sacrifices. And the Torah describes the catastrophe that resulted from that view. Okay. Now let us get back to the problems we have in Deuteronomy 26:3. Question was why he says to God your God, and why it says to the Kohen that will exist in your days. All right. So the question is, so Rashi says that you must treat each Kohen with the same respect as the, so Nachmanides says, of course, you mean every Kohen, you can't have an inferior Kohen, either is a Kohen or is not, there's no level. But what I am pointing to is the fact that you see the Kohen was really designated to be not just the one that serves in the temple, but to be the teacher, because he has the time and he has, and therefore what God did was, he freed a segment of the population so that they can actually be designated to be teachers. What Rashi is referring to over here is not the Kohen insofar as he is serves in the temple, but the Kohen insofar as he is a scholar and a teacher. Now, what does this mean? Why does he say, now we can understand what it means when he says, I have a story this day to say today, before God, your God. What it means by God, your God, is that the individual, this person who made the pilgrimage, when he brings the first fruit, the first thing he must say is, he must admit to the fact that he does not have the knowledge of God that the scholar has. And that's why he says to the Kohen, he says, God, your God. The Kohen is the one who represents scholarship. He's the representative, as it says in Deuteronomy 33:10. They teach your judgments to Jacob and your Torah to Israel. On the whole, they were the main teachers. The Kohen is used in several places in Tanakh to indicate a teacher. It says, the lips of the Kohen guard knowledge. The Kohen is used to indicate a person who is very knowledgeable. So what Rashi is explaining is like this, that when the pilgrim comes, the first thing he must admit is the fact that the one that has true knowledge of God is not himself, the Kohen, the learned man. He knows. He has knowledge of God. I don't have that knowledge. Okay? So he's not speaking to this Kohen in particular. He's speaking to the concept, to the general, to the tribe of the Kohanim, the statement is a reference to. It means the ones that have knowledge of God are the ones that are the scholars. And that's why Rashi says that you must respect the Kohen in your generation, even if the scholarship is not as great. So you'll say, well, why should I say that I don't have the knowledge of God? Is God your God? You're the one that has more knowledge, that has the knowledge of God. I don't have that knowledge. Why do I have to make that admission to this group of priests? Maybe years ago I would say that if Aaron were here, if there were other times when they had great scholars, but today I don't feel like doing that. The Torah says you have to treat him in your generation as if he were the greatest. You have no right to, you can't distinguish, because the general idea is since in general he has the Kohen is the one that's dedicated to knowledge.
Rabbi?
Yes.
We got to turn the tape.
Okay.
And you'll have to say the Kohen is. Okay. The question, Rabbi, that I would like to ask you,
yeah,
where you said that the Kohen had a he was the scholar, so he called him the Lord your God.
Right.
But then he goes down and he talks about the Lord who swore unto our fathers to give us.
Yeah,
so he's
right.
Identifying with the same God.
Same God, yeah.
Okay. Right. But he just said, you're saying that the Kohen has a superior knowledge.
That's correct.
Okay, a superior knowledge
superior
to the
knowledge.
To the
right.
normal man out there, because
right.
he's spending 50 weeks a year studying, and
that's
the guy
right.
that's coming up is not spending that time studying.
That's exactly right.
Okay, all right.
Okay.
I'm clear then. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay, so here we see how the Torah demands that when the person recognize the fact that the scholar, the man that studies Torah on a full-time basis, this person has a greater knowledge of God than the person who doesn't, who is ignorant. Okay, now it's interesting. Take a look at Jeremiah 10:7. Jeremiah 10:7 makes a very interesting statement. In 10:6, he speaks about that there is no one like God. He says, "You are great, and your name is great and powerful." Then in verse 7, he says, "Who does not fear you, O King of the nations?" Because that is appropriate for you to be feared, in other words. And then he says, "Because among all the wise men of the nations and all their kingdoms, they all say that there is none like you." Okay? I don't know what your translation is, but that's it's an elliptical statement. There's one part missing there, and I just supplied what is missing. But it says because among all the wise men of the nations and in all their kingdom, there is none like you. But that, of course, is nonsensical. Obviously, no human being can compare to God. But as an elliptical statement, what it means is because among all the wise men of the nations and in all their kingdom, they all say that there is none like you, which fits into exactly what he was saying before. So I don't know which way you have it in your translation, but that's the proper translation. Now, the question is, he is speaking about all the nations. Now, Jeremiah was a monotheist. Jeremiah was a prophet. Jeremiah was a very great learned person, and he, as a matter of fact, he was a Kohen. He was a priest also, as you know. And he says that everyone fears God. That's wonderful. Everyone fears God, then the Torah's work is done. What does he mean when he says, "Everyone who does not fear you, King of the nations"? Okay? What does he mean? What he means is that, you see, the other nations also recognize the one God. And I mentioned this many times before, that the Egyptians recognized one God, but they worshipped sub-deities. What Judaism taught the world is that there are no sub-deities, and worship must be done exclusively to the one God in the manner that he directs through prophecy. That's what Judaism taught people. Not that there is one God. There are many primitive people that recognize one God. If I'm not mistaken, I think even the American Indians recognize one God, one spirit in the universe. But their service was always to the sub-deities. People make a mistake when they think that the Torah taught the idea of one God. The idea of one God was known. The worship of one God was never known until Torah. The worship was always worship of sub-deities. That's where the primitivism was. So what Jeremiah says is, your name is great among the nations. Everyone recognizes the one God. Now, what it means is like this, you see. This is what you have to understand. That recognition of God takes place on many levels. And that's what the Torah is saying. When you come to the Kohen, he is the one you must admit that your recognition of God is on a primitive level compared to his recognition of God. He has a different insight into God. But your concept of God is not zero, it's not nothing, okay? There is, even on the, even in the primitive person, if he recognizes there's one force, he has some idea, even if he thinks that this force, even if he thinks that this force is physical. But okay, that's wrong. That's absolutely wrong, and that's a major violation in Torah. But there is a nuclear, there's a nucleus of some idea of a cause behind everything he sees, you see? So, but of course, that idea is very vague, it's obscured, it's tainted, it's contaminated. But there is something there. What the Torah demands of the person that comes before the Kohen is that he has to recognize that. He has to say, God, you're God. You have the clear, the clearer, the more clear idea, the more precise idea. It's an idea far advanced. It's an idea based upon knowledge. Mine is a lower level, an emotional idea. People say, you know, I was speaking with David this week, David mentioned a point which got me thinking, and as a matter of fact, as driving home, I was thinking about it, and I didn't have an answer at the time, but I believe now that I do have an answer. David mentioned to me, he says, you'll notice among the scholars of Torah, he says, many times, you notice that they don't speak about God. There's no talk of God. And, you know, I mentioned that, of course, it's impossible to construe a Torah without God, and, you know, I was thinking about why it's a... But you see, let me explain to you. I think it's not a defect. I think it is actually... It shows you the holiness of the people. And that is like this. People always... Other religions, they always speak about God because they think they know God, you see? On a primitive level, their primitive idea of God, they are secure and they're certain and they're sure that they know God. So they're always talking about God. But Torah teaches a person, just a moment, your idea of God, you may think you knew God when you were 10 years old, or when you were 5 years old, or 6 years old, but that wasn't really a knowledge of God. That was just a very, very primitive idea. That idea was very contaminated. When you grow older and you study, and the more knowledge of Torah one gains, the more his idea of God becomes purified, rarefied. It's different. The scholar's idea of God is different than the average person, because Torah is knowledge. And in all knowledge, a person reaches closer and closer to God. If he doesn't, then there's something wrong. Then there's something wrong in the process, you see. But if the process goes on normally, then his idea of God has to evolve, change, undergoes change.
Rabbi?
Yes.
All right. Is that another airplane going over?
Another airplane we got, yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, this is not New Hampshire for sure.
That's for sure.
All right. See, I would say that a person, say, 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 years old,
right,
that their idea and concept of God is in direct proportion to the knowledge they possess.
That's correct.
And then they can only relate,
right,
on the level that they understand. So as they get older and their reasoning faculties,
right,
and the rational and their being able to rationalize things, then they can enter to a higher level of understanding of God.
That's correct.
But a person has to, and say, I would not say that his ideas are primitive. They would be, say, to you or a Rabbi Soloveitchi or a Rambam,
right,
definitely a Moses.
Right.
But his idea of God might be superior to any other 5-year-old or 10-year-old or 13-year-old.
Without a question.
So,
there's no question. I am in full agreement with you. I didn't mean primitive in terms of, I didn't mean it derogatorily. I meant, when I said primitive, I didn't mean derogatorily.
Okay,
I meant as you said it, and comparatively.
Okay, all right, okay, all right.
Okay?
Okay, that's where we get. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Now, what I would like to say is that, and this is one of the important, really important principles of Torah, namely, that we recognize this concept, that in Torah, as a person increases his knowledge, he increases his knowledge of God. It goes hand in hand. This is different, far different, a different concept, the concept that that basically other religions were never able to grasp. As a matter of fact, the basic dogma of Christianity is that the scholarship has nothing to do with the with knowledge of God, but rather who will enter into heaven is not dependent on scholarship. It's dependent on his faith and his belief, not his knowledge. This is completely diametrically opposed to Torah. In Torah, as a person increases in knowledge, he increases in his closeness to God, in his closeness to God. As a matter of fact, Descartes, the philosopher Descartes, was raised and studied in a Jesuit college, and of course he was a brilliant person. He's the father of modern mathematics and modern philosophy. And what he was taught in college, in the Jesuit college, was that that the way to heaven is not less open to the most ignorant than to the most learned. You see? And that the revealed truths which lead to heaven are above our comprehension. That's the philosophy of Christianity. Torah is diametrically opposed. In Torah, the more knowledge of Torah you have, the closer you are to God, your idea of God is closer. A person can never really approach God with a positive idea. I'm not going to have this other discussion. But the fact is that the more a person studies, the greater the scholar, the greater his knowledge of Torah, the greater is his knowledge of God, and the closer he is to God. And it's very interesting. See, you'll notice that the Torah really took this whole thing with the first fruits and made a whole issue out of it. It caused the man to come to Jerusalem. It caused him to go before the Kohen, before the priest. It caused him to make these statements, to talk about, tell the whole story of the history of Egypt and going out of Egypt and the miracles and the fact that he came to this land. Why did the Torah take this commandment, this mitzvah, and elaborate so much when there are so many other mitzvahs that you just do them? For instance, giving the Kohen it's not tithes, it's called truma, okay, or giving the Levite his tithes. There's no ceremoniousness. Over here, there is a whole formula. He has to give this whole speech. Why did the Torah do it in this case? Now here is where Maimonides comes in. Maimonides explains that when you study the primitive idolaters, you find that the first fruits were something around which all kinds of ceremonials and fertility rites and primitive rituals abounded. So I just saw recently a show where they showed in Africa how the primitive tribes, they still have it today actually, where they believe that the earth is the powers of the earth bring forth the fruits and the different powers in the earth. And this, of course, is primitivism, is idolatry. Now, the Torah never goes against the instincts. And the same thing with the religious instinct. The Torah recognizes that religious instinct is the most dangerous, because idolatry is unbridled religious instinct. But the Torah works with man and tries to take his instinctual and direct it towards Torah and towards the one true God. So what does the Torah do? The first fruits are a very exciting thing. The earth's the product of the earth, of one's toil, of this. One second, plane. And the excitement and the fears that the earth will not produce, the dangers, famine. This is man's whole life depends on the on food. And therefore, the primitive people always have these rites surrounding the first fruits. The Torah says, the Torah makes sure that this doesn't happen. So what does the Torah say? The Torah says, take the first fruits. Where do you take it? You take it to the temple. Who's in the temple? The Kohen. is the Kohen? The Kohen is a scholar. He's a person that has knowledge, as it says in Deuteronomy. He does both. He serves and he teaches. Because just to serve, to do performances without any knowledge, is worthless in the eyes of God. So the Kohen must be, it was intended that the Kohen, the man who does the service in the temple, should understand the service, should understand Torah, should have a higher understanding of God. Then when the pilgrim comes, the plain person comes to him, he can be sure that he will not act in any primitive way. The first thing he must do when he sees the Kohen, he must admit and mention, God, your God. You have a greater knowledge of God. You can identify, your concept of God is greater than mine. Okay? He is your God. I submit to your knowledge. I recognize that you have a superior knowledge. And he takes these first fruits, and what does he do? And he recites a whole story about the first fruits. First of all, he says the land was sworn to not because of me, but because of our fathers, because of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then he says, and he goes through the whole story about the fact that he was taken out of Egypt, and the fact that God. And you take a look. Take a look at verse 9, 26:9. And he brought us to this place, and he gave us this land. Why the emphasis? The emphasis is that the person should never think that the land is anything special. The land doesn't produce fruit. This land doesn't have any magical powers. No, nothing special about the land. God brought us to this land, to this place, and he gave us this land, a wonderful land. It's a bountiful land. It's a good land. But it's all from God. He is the only... He's the only source. There is no other source. There's nothing magical about the land, nothing special about the land. It's just that God knew that we needed a land. He brought us to this place. You notice that he brought us to this place. He brought us to this place implies there's a practicality involved. We have to have a land. He gave us this land. He brought us to this place. And he gave us this land, and it's a wonderful land. But there's nothing special about the land. The special is that God gave us this place to live, and therefore, he says, and now I brought the first fruits, take a look, he says, which you, God, have given me. Who is the one that is beneficent is God, okay? And then he places it before God, and he bows down before God, and then he rejoices with the fact that God has benefited him. Okay? This is where the Torah takes the emotions that a person might have, misguided emotions that would cause primitive idolatrous practices, and raises them to the highest level. But you'll notice it begins with a recognition of the fact that the scholar, the one that has knowledge, has a greater idea, a more correct idea of God, closer, different idea than he does. That, and there again, I said, as I mentioned last week, the Torah recognizes that the greatest danger to its system is each person alone thinking that he has... Sorry, excuse me. Each person thinking alone to himself that he has the inside track to God. He can feel that it's not based on knowledge. See, knowledge is universal. Knowledge is not something that a person can keep to himself. Feelings are specific, are individual. When a person maintains he's superior because he has a holy feeling, he's holy, no one can argue that. I mean, and it's not an objective thing. Yeah, I'm holy, I'm close to God. Why? Because I feel that way. Yeah, but... You feel that way, and millions of other people feel that way as well. This is something which stems from man's megalomania, his egomania, that he thinks he wants to insist on the fact that he's special, he's God's chosen. No. That's not correct in the eyes of Torah. Chosen, what's chosen? A person who has knowledge is the one that... The one that has knowledge is the one that is closer to God. And he can't hoard the knowledge for himself. He can't be God's favorite. There's no such thing. There is only... God's system is objective. It's based upon knowledge. The one that has knowledge is the one that is close to God, is the one that has the correct idea of God insofar as man is capable of achieving. achieving such an idea. And that's what the pilgrim has to say at that moment when he brings the first fruit, to remove himself from any traces of primitivism. That's what the Torah does. The beauty and the greatness of Torah is how it takes man, it doesn't deny the instinct, it doesn't even deny the primitive instinct. It recognizes it. You have to meet the person, and this is something we say constantly. And it's something that David has incorporated in his practice, to meet the person where he is. The Torah meets the person, recognizes the person's emotion. It wants him to be honest with his emotions. It doesn't want him to deny his emotions. Be honest with him, but it channels it away from the root to disaster, and channels it to the root of Torah knowledge. And this is a beautiful example in this particular commandment of how beautifully it's formulated, and how it teaches the person the correct idea of God. And when he walks away from the temple, he walks away with a totally different knowledge. Even though he may not have gained in terms of study, but it's a different awareness, and that awareness should lead to an involvement in study and pursuit of knowledge. And that's the way, that's the direction that's how the Torah guides a person. So again, I just wanted to point out that the arch enemy of the Torah is when people think that on their own, their own imaginings, that they're close to God. It is simply, as I said before, it's simply part of man's sick ego that he wants to be God's favorite. Everybody wants to, that's an emotion which is counterproductive, which causes a person to get involved in fantasy and actually takes them away from God. And here's where you see how the Torah actually, again, recognizes the danger of such an idea. That's what I wanted to bring to your attention. I just felt there was an opportunity since we're involved in that, so I continued a little bit with the digression. But what I'd like to do is, if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer the questions. If not, I'll start my road back to the Talmud that we were doing. So I leave it to you at this point.
All right, Jeff has got a question. All right, Jeff. All right, the statement in verse 9, the land flowing with milk and honey.
Right.
That's an idiomatic statement.
Yes.
Okay, so explain that to him.
The land that flows with milk and honey is an expression. It's used several times in the Bible. It just means a wonderful land. By the way, the honey doesn't mean bee honey. Okay, there's certain things that you have to. It's funny, when we see certain terms in the Torah and in the Tanakh, we immediately think of something that we're familiar with, but it's not necessarily correct. Over here, because of when it speaks about the honey, it means. They used to make date honey, because it comes from the land, okay? And the honey over here is not referring to bee honey. As a matter of fact, that was one of the questions in the Talmud: is how do you know you're permitted to eat bee honey? Because it comes from an insect which is non-kosher, and anything which comes from something which is non-kosher is prohibited to eat. So there, the Talmud explains that the bee doesn't really produce the honey; he takes the nectar from the flowers, and he's involved in the process through adding enzymes to it. But that's not considered. It's not actually considered a part of his. It's not his body. It's not part of his body. The honey's not flowing from him, from the bee. That's why it's miserable. But this, but Thomas says, why don't I use this verse where it says honey? Thomas says, no, that's referring to the honey that comes from one of the seven. Things that grow in Israel, which is the dates. But it's an expression. It just means to say it's a beautiful land. It's a land which gives forth its produce. It's a very productive land. As a matter of fact, and when they complain to Moses, so they use that expression. They said, "You didn't take us to a land of that flows of milk and honey." Okay. So it's an expression. But over here, that's why they mention it over here is, again, because what he's trying to say is It is a wonderful land. There's nothing, it's wonderful. God gave us this land. It is a wonderful land. He wants to appreciate the fact that it's wonderful, but not to think that it has some magical powers. It's because God gave it to us. It's a wonderful land, and God gave it to us. But it all stems from God, that there's nothing special, magical about the land. You know very well that you remember the tribes when they entered into the land. So 2.5 tribes took land on the other side of Jordan. They said that we have sheep, and they told Moses, they said, well, you know, we'd rather stay here. And that is, Moses agreed, and you see this, and now that part of Israel, that's also part of, that also has a law of being a part of the land of Israel. But land of Israel is not a, according to Allah, actually, any area that is under the sovereignty of the nation of Israel becomes a part of the land of Israel. Okay? So again, you see how the halacha removes any kind of magical attachment to the to a specific land.
Okay. I mean, Rabbi, you got 60 seconds.
Okay. All right. It could be, even Italy. It could be anywhere. It could be any country in the world. If it's under the sovereignty of the only thing is that you're not permitted. You're not permitted to take any land before you have the land which is designated in the Torah. Okay, any other question?
I think that'll take care of us, and rather than getting back on the Talmudic end of it, see, this can come under the law of the one God.
Okay.
So this is still the Talmudic end of it.
Okay.
So we'll begin there next week.